And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
And I'm still drinking.
I'm Tori Clark. This is Chatter on Books. We're back at our favorite undisclosed location, 49th show, kids.
Oh, my God.
One more, and we'll just say that's it.
That's it.
We never thought we would get that far. Happy 2020 to everybody. We've got a lot going on tonight. We're going to have a great show next week, too. I think I just have this feeling we're going to have a great show next week. We got some random thoughts. I've got an email from Gene Weingarten I have to share. Susan Page is sitting next to me. Do you know Gene Weingarten?
I worship at the feet of Gene Weingarten.
You might change after you hear this email.
Do you want me to leave the room for this one?
Yeah. In honor of the big game tonight, LSU versus Clemson. What time, David? What time is kick?
I think is it 8:30?
Okay, you'll all be gone way before that.
Probably.
We're going to talk about books from college that impacted you, stayed with you. Susan Page, sitting to my right, USA Today reporter extraordinaire. I don't want to admit how long I've known you because that would be way too scary. And she's the author of The Matriarch, Barbara Bush. Everybody here knows I have very mixed feelings about memoirs. I really, really like this one. We'll talk about that a lot more. And in Deserted Island, we're going to talk about New Year's reading resolutions.
Yes.
But first up, before we get to anything else, and before I do Calvert Woodley, Houston, David, I'm look to you. Houston, what? The news Houston, from Houston.
The city? The football team?
Let me go get the trash can.
Wow.
Are you surprised by that?
I wasn't surprised that some penalties came down for them, even though I think it's just endearing. Stealing signs has been part of baseball since there was baseball.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, stealing signs with technology is terrible. But it is what it is. The rules are the rules. We all expected penalties to come down. That severe?
That was surprising. I will admit, the suspensions were not surprising. The fact that the owner of the team said, yeah, get out, you're fired. That was surprising. Shocking, even. Because if I'm one of them, I'd go, didn't you tell us to do this?
Yeah.
These are marching orders to do this. You know, where's your plausible deniability? So it will be interesting to see the fallout from this. From A.J. Hinch, who is viewed universally around baseball as one of the genuinely good people
right.
in the sport. Just a stand-up guy in all ways. So for him to take the fall for this is like, wow. That's
and
a wow.
Does he have to sit out now for a couple of years, then gets
rehired?
Well,
he's suspended for a year, but yeah. you know, he's fired. He is no longer the manager of the Houston Astros.
And how do their contracts work?
You got to pay him off.
Wow.
Got to pay him. He's got a contract.
That amazes me. So the contract doesn't say if you get...
I mean...
I'm sure there might be some moral clause.
Things, but I kind of doubt that that's enforceable.
But it's interesting that you wait until after the decision comes down yeah. from sort of league down rather than preempting it on your own, where you might be able to invoke one of those clauses
right.
with a little bit more success. But then you try and look, what is going to happen elsewhere in the league? What, you know, because Core is still going to be under investigation.
Sure.
It goes down to Beltran, who they say will not be viewed as a manager because he was still playing then.
Right.
But what is then the impact on all these other teams?
Yeah, no, I don't think they would ever, I doubt they would ever have... They could not have possibly fired him for cause.
Yeah.
You don't really want to go through discovery on that trial,
right.
do you?
Exactly.
Do you really want to do that? I don't think the owner of the Astros wants to do that. So, it is shocking. The GM,
$5 million bucks. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
For anybody.
A lot of money. Well,
Susan Page is sitting here going, I thought this was a show about books.
It is.
We ran. We go down lots of other paths, Susan. Just warning
you.
It
was just such a surprise.
Yeah.
And look, I would love to think that the local team has never done anything like this. I'm not that naive. I cover sports for a living.
Again, one of the many books I think you should write is that, well, it's true in business too. Every sport at the highest levels, even the most successful people who will win most of the time anyhow, cheat in business. Even the people who make billions of dollars.
Of course, they cheat better
the
than everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So not cheating. I was at Calvert Woodley today. We have to talk about this. David, you're having some of the red wine from Calvert Woodley.
This fantastic red wine.
It's Italian. Bill pulled this for us over there. Nero d'Avola. Which is from Sicily, the vineyard is Lamuri. It's supposed to be soft tannins.
It's very good. And I like red wine, as you know.
Yes.
It seemed to be a touch dry, but it does. It's
That's
not
what Bill said.
But it's not.
Your wine vocabulary.
I know. I'm getting awfully pretentious hanging out with you all.
Go back to baseball.
It goes great with the cheese that you ordered.
Well, and segue, and Michael's trying the cheese. So Ibrahim at La Cheeserie pulled. He's very excited when he saw the Italian wine, and he always talks about it comes from cows and goats and sheep's and this and that. It's always sheep's plural, but he seems like sheep's milk the best. And this is a Pecorino Toscano. Michael,
very
you loving
mild.
It?
Yeah. It's salty, but not overpowering.
There you go. So if you go to Calvert Woodley, they tell me it's a little slow in January. So you go over there, you can get greater attention from the wonderful staff there.
Maybe you can find parking this time of year.
Exactly.
The parking's actually pretty good.
Use them for your Super Bowl parties that are coming up.
Yeah, we're having one of those in a little bit.
Are you
thanks
really?
For the invite.
Yeah, we are. Yeah,
do you have
invited.
Themed foods?
It is nachos, wings, chili.
There you go.
That's it. That's all you get. Okay. Gene Weingarten was on a few weeks ago. We love Gene, and he is quite the curmudgeon. And right before Christmas, running around, I have a copy of the book here. I'm running around desperately trying to find something for our daughter because I hadn't gotten her many things. And I see this beautiful, I'm holding up for News Channel 8, book about old dogs. It's a photo book about old dogs. It's a great picture. I just grab it, buy it, give it to her. She loves it. We're all looking at it. We love it. And I read it's done by Gene Weingarten. Who is
How
a fan?
That?
I'll let Michael take a look at
oh
that.
My gosh.
He
is
a fan. I'm just going to pass this along.
No. Yeah, because of your close connection. Now, so it's the sweetest,
the
kindest.
Dogs are cute.
Yeah, it's the sweetest, kindest thing you've ever seen in your life. And Susan, if you spend a little time with Gene Weingarten, he is quite the curmudgeon.
I actually have a Gene Weingarten story, although we have never met.
Go for it.
Which is one of my sons, who hates it when I talk about him, so I try to do it as often as possible.
Michael
was a
can relate.
Reporter in Detroit, and then in Concord, New Hampshire, and then in Washington, although now he's gone on to more honorable work. And he called me on the edge of hysteria one day saying, "Oh my God, Gene Weingarten has followed me on Twitter."
Oh.
I said, "Why do you
That's
think he's
deal.
Done that?" I said, I don't know. But it was like, it was a highlight of his young reporting career. Now, maybe it was an accident. Maybe Gene Weingarten thought he was following some other person. But my son, Ben, was thrilled.
Well, he's our first two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. Yes. We've had a Pulitzer Prize winner or two on the show. Yeah. It's the first two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. But he puts the mudgeon in curmudgeon. Yeah. So I look at this, week after Christmas, I see this cute, sweet book. And I think, oh, my God, Gene Weingarten did this. So I send him an email saying, "Hey, Happy New Year. Hope you're doing well. Desperately racing around. Got this book for my daughter. She loved it. We all loved it. And I couldn't believe it was yours. It's so lovely. Thanks for helping us realize there's a lovely heart in your curmudgeonly persona. All the best, Tori." 3 seconds later, I get an email back from him, and it says, "Thanks, kid, and bleep you." Only bleep is not what he said in the email. "Kidding, just keeping up the curmudgeon, polishing my brand. I appreciate the note." But he's a multi-talented guy and has a special relationship with Tony Kornheiser. Michael?
Sure.
Okay, then, staying in the Christmas book theme, my children and my husband, knowing me, got me Tequila Mockingbird, which is,
nice.
I'll just read the back. "Congrats, you fought through War and Peace, burned through Fahrenheit 451, and sailed through Moby Dick. All right, you nearly drowned in Moby Dick, the worst book ever. But you made it to shore, and you deserve a drink. A fun gift for barflies and a terrific treat for book clubs, Tequila Mockingbird is the ultimate cocktail book for the literary obsessed. Features 65 drink recipes paired with wry commentary on history's most beloved novels. The book also includes bar bites, etc., drinking games." And it really is wonderful. And it will have, I'll just read a few titles of the chapters. I go right to, accidentally, Moby Drink. Talks about how dreadful the book Moby Dick was. The Count of Monte Cristal. And it goes on. It's a great little book.
I got 20 pages into Moby Dick, and I said, this isn't going to happen.
835 pages of tying knots. Michael, did
Don't
you like Moby
the
Dick?
Whale fat.
That's right. Is that like duck fat?
I wouldn't
Susan,
try
did you ever read? Did you ever read Moby Dick?
I was once guest hosting the Diane Rehm Show,
uh-huh.
And it was one of her book club things where she did like a classic book of unparalleled excellence.
You had to do,
and
Moby
I
Dick.
Could not read it. I would try to read it, and I would fall asleep over and over again. I finally went to a bookstore and bought the Cliff's Notes version of this sacred text because that's the only way I was going to get.
Well, no
it.
One's actually read all of it.
I don't think Noble read all of it. Okay, last one up. Michael, you like this. the most looked up words.
So what I love about this show is Tori always sends a rundown, and then you show up to the undisclosed location, and there's something printed that you have not yet
well,
seen.
Well, I just saw it late this afternoon.
I know, so this is some of 2019's most searched words have roots in Washington, which I sort of love the idea of year-in-review stuff, trying to figure out what are people looking up in terms of dictionaries, because I think you go to the dictionary, you're trying to find sense of your questions, your problems, you're trying to make the world make sense to you. And a lot of times it's intentionally done in a way that doesn't have dialogue coming back to you. Maybe you're afraid of what you're looking up. Maybe you just want to have resting time to try and figure out your own thoughts. But that's why I love the addition of the Washington angle to some of these.
Yeah. Which ones surprised you? Any of them? Quid pro quo did not surprise me. I just love that people are looking up words. That, to me, is encouraging.
That's good.
Right?
That's a good sign.
Yeah, because I would always say, you know, with my background in literature and teaching, I always go straight to the OED, and you're trying to figure out the second, third, fourth sort of inflection points for some of these words. Where have they changed over the years? How might they be used different in, say, an old text versus how we use them colloquially today? I actually found the most interesting was the uptick in searches surrounding pronouns and the way that we are identifying
which
ourselves.
Makes sense.
Which makes sense, and I think that's a healthy way to try and learn more rather than, I don't know, it's easy not to search or it's easy to criticize rather than opening yourself up to learn there.
Yeah, I again, I'm amazed that people look up words, which is good. And of course, I used to go to my ginormous dictionary, which I loved, which I still have somewhere upstairs. But now, of course, you just Google everything, you know, definition of. And I think if anybody ever looked at my search history, wow, some really stupid words.
Well, and they do that city by city.
Mostly pornographic ones or what?
Not a bit. Okay, so not long after we leave here tonight, it is going to be LSU versus Clemson in the championship game. David, I'll go to you first. Is it, as James Carville has said, if LSU wins, will they be the best team in college history in 150 years?
No.
Is it going to be the best game ever?
We'll find out. I mean, I doubt it. Oh, I shouldn't say I doubt it. It will have to climb a very steep ladder to be the best game ever. There's a few nominees. There was a Texas at USC championship game a few years ago that was pretty special. That had like five Heisman Trophy winners in it. So we'll see, I guess is what I would say before we're taping this before the game. But it certainly has what you want, which is two great, not good, great quarterbacks. So from that standpoint, you're anticipating a great game, but there's no guarantee.
Two great coaches. Fabulous coaches.
Yes.
I just keep thinking Clemson, you know, LSU is such a great story, and Orgeron's got that great voice, and just wonderful, wonderful. But I just keep thinking Clemson's been there. They've been there many times in the last 4 or 5 years.
That counts for something.
That counts for a lot.
Yes, it counts for something. Not all of the people that were on those teams before are there now, but it does count for something.
How much? It's essentially a home field advantage.
Yes, for LSU. So that will be very interesting if the game is close late, how that will factor in, and the crowd noise in a dome stadium could be
Michael,
important.
Michael, you placing bets?
I have no sense of college football.
At all.
None at all. It's growing up in this area.
That Penn football team was right up there.
Hoorah, hoorah. I'm going to go into that. No, I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
I got nothing bad, Tori.
Okay, you didn't. It's an excellent segue to David's segment here about books that impact us in college. Go, David.
Well, see, now, I left it purposely vague because I didn't know if it was books about people in college that you liked or books that you read in college. Because there's several different types depending on the category we use. The first one that came to mind was books about people who were in college that you read about. And so The Accidental Billionaires by Ben Mezrich is the one that I would think of, because I still can't believe that a kid in college created Facebook. It's just hard to believe. It happened. It obviously happened. But it is a very tangible way for me to remember that there are people who are so much smarter than I am. It's scary, and it's depressing how much smarter people are than I am that can do something like that when they're 19.
Yeah, but what's he done since then?
Yeah. Come on.
So, D.A., your open-ended question preempted what I normally like to do with one of Tori's
Rewrite
and just sort of flip it around in a way that helps me. No,
exactly.
So I could easily go back to something like Normal People, Secret History, mm-hmm. any of the books that we've talked about already over the 48 previous episodes of right. the show. But I wanted to go back to two texts that really were game changers for me as a undergraduate. The first would be, I think it was in my Rise of the Novel class, and it was the History of Tom Jones, Foundling, the Henry Fielding.
Wow.
And if I'm going to use Tori's first prompt cool. of looking something up, this is a Buildings Roman, which we use a lot, but it's okay to try and remind people that this is a novel dealing with one person's formative years or spiritual education. And here we have a book that sets out when the time it's in the 18th century. The novel doesn't exist the way that we see it now. And so many of us look, we want to learn more about ourselves. We want to try and understand the human condition more. And this is one of those texts that sort of sets that precedent and really opened my eyes as a reader. And it's delightful. It has one of the most funny scenes involving food at an inn and just the baseness of eating and eating around other people and a character that you hate, but you also love him. And it's like watching your favorite serialized show on Netflix right now. It holds up. And the other would be later, I took an African-American literature course with Dr. Herman Beavers, who was a just tremendous teacher and incorporated journaling into your everyday activities. And it was probably the most diverse class that I took at Penn. And I struggled a lot with it, but there was one short story by Charles Chestnut called The Gopher Grapevine, which is subversive. It flips your expectations. How do you get a story at a time when African-American authors are not featured in such things as The Atlantic? Well, you have to play to an audience that wants certain tropes and plays up caricatures, and it does that, and then it completely turns them around. And that was really the first time that I'd seen something like that done in what you'd consider school reading.
Mm-hmm. Is it like Jonathan Swift almost?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it has that sort of satire, mm-hmm. you know, idea.
Awesome.
Excellent ones. So I took it as, what books did you read in college that had a big impact on you? And I can happily admit, I just didn't read at all. Grade school, high school, just didn't read at all unless I was absolutely forced to. And part of it was because I detested my older sisters, and they all read a ton of fiction. So I was like, ugh, I'm not going to do that. But I get to college and flunking as a pre-vet major, and for reasons I don't really remember, two books. It was in 77, 78. One was The Thornbirds, Colleen McCullough. It's a big book.
It's a lot of book.
And it just made me go, wow, this fiction stuff is kind of cool. And the other was Roots. And going back to by Alex Haley, something we talked about earlier, growing up in Pittsburgh in the 70s, you're not being taught a lot about black history in this country. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I had read anything. And that really stayed with me. And then what we were just talking about, I got a dictionary. I remember it coming, rolling on to Christmas, my mother going, oh my God, what do you want for Christmas? And I asked for, and she just about fell over dead. She was shocked that I asked for this ginormous dictionary, which wow. weighed about 20 pounds. And so I still have it. That had a huge impact on me.
Did you ever crack the spine?
Yes. Yeah, all the time. We didn't have stickies then, but, you know, right. pieces of paper and things like that. Susan, any big college books stay with you?
That's a hard one because my college years are sort of a blur.
Yeah, yeah, that happens.
You know, I took a course from Dennis Brutus, who was a South African poet, who was then in exile from South Africa. Huh. And it was a course devoted to South African poets, which would seem obscure, and I have no idea why I signed up for it, but it was really compelling because it was so off what I was doing yeah. every other hour of the week. It was about political protest and personal living and liberation and imprisonment and God knows what he thought about this class at Northwestern University, but it was very powerful to me. And I was glad when the day came when he could move back to South Africa.
Yeah, that came back to you pretty easily, actually. Good for you.
It's the excellent white wine.
Here we go. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back with Susan Page, and we'll refill some glasses. We're back. It is Chatter on Books 49th episode, and we are very, very happy to have Susan Page with us, just Washington correspondent, political guru extraordinaire. again, I don't want to say how long Susan and I have known each other, but I think since the 80s, right? When I worked for McCain, is that when we would have first met?
That's probably right. I've been in Washington even longer than that.
So yeah.
It could have been before.
Yeah. And she's got a fabulous book out now, The Matriarch About Barbara Bush, another one coming up on Nancy Pelosi. But I love the backstory part. So let's do the backstory. You're a girl from the heartland.
I am.
Wichita.
Was born and raised in Wichita. And in fact, when I went to Northwestern to start my freshman year, it was the first time I had spent a night outside of Kansas.
Wow. Wow. And Wichita, was Wichita a big aircraft place then?
It was, although one of the stunning surprises to me when I started going to college was that in Chicago, people did not think of Wichita as a big city, because in Kansas, Wichita is the biggest city. But that kind of regard was not, I discovered, universally held.
Yeah, I lived in Topeka. Wichita was considered huge.
Are you from Topeka?
No, I worked there once on a congressional campaign. Yeah.
You have to be born, raised, and never leave to really claim Kansas status.
I like Kansas a lot, and I like Topeka a lot. What's the town with the largest ball of twine? Is it Hutchinson? I think
it's a secret.
Yeah, Kansas has got a lot going on. So you almost didn't become a journalist, though.
Really? What have you heard?
Music.
Oh well, I was, and this of course sounds ridiculous as we all sound when we think about high school. But I was a very serious oboe player.
But back up. How does one pick the oboe?
One's mother gives one an oboe in the third grade and says you're going to take lessons in that. Yeah. I played the oboe, my brother played the bassoon, my sister played the trombone. We all played musical instruments. But I was actually quite a serious oboist. I went to summer music camp. I was a soloist with the Kansas Youth Symphony Orchestra, which, again, a revelation to me that other states did not consider that one of the really top youth symphony orchestras, but we did. But when I was a senior in high school at Wichita High School Southeast, go Buffaloes, I had to choose because it didn't seem like a natural match to be a newspaper reporter and an oboist.
I don't know. You could be the music critic and...
Yeah. So for whatever reason, I chose journalism.
Newspaper was the Hoofbeats. Did I read that somewhere?
The Hoofbeats was the newspaper at my high school, and the Stampede was the yearbook, which fits, as you can guess, with the Golden Buffaloes.
Of course. What were the big issues that the newspaper covered?
Well, the high school paper actually had a lot to cover because there was, you know... We were talking a little about race. We've got Martin Luther King Day coming up. Wichita's high schools were pretty segregated. I mean, not formally segregated, but segregated because neighborhoods tended to be segregated. So one of the big controversies was, would they send African-American students to my high school, which was pretty much 100% white? And that didn't happen until I was there. I mean, that was pretty late in the day.
Kansas was Brown versus Board of Education.
That's right. Yeah. And they didn't change the neighborhoods, but they started busing in African-American kids who I'm sure had a very tough time and a different experience than I had at Southeast.
Yeah. What made you, so you had two paths, music and journalism. What sent you down the journalism path?
Well, you know, it's like my only skill.
It's most
I mean,
of us.
Yeah. So thank God. Thank God. You know, my only skill within journalism has become covering politics in the White House. Thank God we keep holding elections.
Yeah.
This will be my 11th election. Please don't stop doing them. There'll be nothing for me to do.
No time soon. But Northwestern, you edited the newspaper there?
I did.
The Daily Northwestern?
I did.
What were those big issues?
Those were, that was during war protests. And so those were. We had big protests on campus. I was there during the Kent State shootings, and that was really the dominant issue.
Did you ever get crosswise with the administration, what the newspaper was doing? There was an amazing story today about a high school student getting crosswise, I mean, very bravely getting crosswise with the school who didn't them to write a certain kind of story. And she said,
well,
no, we're going to do this.
I tell you, I was editor. The Daily Northwestern was independent, although we were housed in university building, but they bought newspapers from us. They didn't finance us. They, you know, support us in a way, but we were considered independent. They did nothing to infringe on that independence. But I will tell you one story. I was the editor-in-chief of the Daily Northwestern, and my senior year, the chancellor decided to have a dinner honoring student leaders. And he invited the managing editor, not me, because the place where he had chosen to have it wouldn't let women through the door.
Hey, now.
Wow.
So to the annoyance of my managing editor, I said he could not attend.
Good for you.
Good.
Wow. That's remarkable. Things have changed just a little.
A little bit.
Hey, Michael, where you've taught, newspapers, big deal or not a big deal anymore?
Not as much as it used to
yeah.
be.
That's too bad.
It is sad.
That's really too bad. Okay, so you choose this crazy path,
yeah.
but it's guaranteed lifetime work, which
we
is
hope.
Good.
Yeah.
And you have covered a lot of administrations.
Six
you,
administrations.
Yep. Yeah, you covered a lot of things going on in this town and elsewhere. You could have written about a lot of different people. Mm-hmm. What caused you to choose Barbara Bush?
Well, you know, I covered seven campaigns in which Barbara Bush played a role. Mm-hmm. And everybody always loved Barbara Bush. And voters would say, oh, she's so sweet. Oh, she's a wonderful grandmother. Oh, I bet she bakes the best cookies. Mm-hmm. And if you know Barbara Bush even a little bit, you know that that is not true.
No.
That is not who Barbara Bush is. That she was, it's not that she wasn't sweet. It was that she was also tough and she could be mean. And she, I can tell you, never baked cookies. Just ask her children or her grandchildren. She was a force of nature who exerted a fair amount of influence over both her husband's administration and her son's administration. Maybe you could talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And she was also a woman who, I think, reflecting her era, was just constantly underestimated.
Mm-hmm.
She was underestimated by her mother, by her teachers. She was underestimated by her husband. And in the interviews I did with her, I concluded that she was underestimated by herself.
Mm-hmm. So this, again, these guys hear all the time. I'm not a big fan of most political memoirs because usually the politician himself or herself writes them. They write them so defensively, and you just don't really get much more than you already knew if you just followed them in daily life. This book, The Matriarch, is so well fueled by her diaries. What caused her? She kept very consistent diaries, writing almost every day. And what caused her at a certain point near the end of her life to say, I'm going to give those to Susan Page?
So first let me say that I'd never done a book before. I made a decision, possibly idiotic, which was to sign a contract to write the book without actually contacting her.
Yeah, details. Mm-hmm. Details. Yeah,
exactly. Details.
And
yeah.
I did
fix it
that,
in post.
Yeah, I did that because I thought if she said, I'm not cooperating with you, I would have chickened out. But if she said, yes, I'll cooperate with you, that she would think she had some sway over what I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not want to do the kind of authorized memoir that you mentioned as being so unsatisfying. I wanted to do a piece of journalism. I wanted to be able to write whatever I found out. So it was after I signed the contract that I sent her a letter saying, hey, I've signed this contract. I sure hope you'll let me interview you.
Mm.
And she said, after some back and forth, she said I could interview her once in Houston. She started the interview by saying, don't even ask me about my diaries. You can't see them, which I understood because let's take a show of hands. If you had a lifetime of diaries, would you let a reporter see them?
Probably not.
Because, no, probably not. Believe me.
Unless I was the reporter.
Which I am. But at the end of the fifth interview I did with her, so I had these extended interviews with her in Houston, and I'd asked her to think about whether I could see the part of her diaries that dealt with Reza Gorbachev, which mm-hmm. was a topic I was very interested in. And at the end of the fifth interview, I said, and these were almost the last words we spoke, because unbeknownst to either one of us, she would die before our sixth interview mm-hmm. took place.
Mm.
She said, I said, oh, I was getting up to leave. I said, oh, have you thought about whether I can see your Reza Gorbachev diaries? And she said, I've thought about it. You can see them all.
Did you about drop over?
I said, the world's stupidest thing. I said, are you sure? Like, you know, somebody
You're
gives
supposed
you
to be good at the follow-up
I know. If somebody gives you a big gift, don't say, oh, you sure you don't want this back? This is wise, really. No. And, of course, Barbara Bush was pretty sure about everything.
Yes.
And so this extraordinary diaries that went back to 1948.
Yeah.
When she was a young mother in Midland. The final diary entry she wrote was the day the doctor came in to say she was going to die.
Mm.
Very sharp in her mind
totally.
To the very end.
Totally
to the
sharp.
Very end.
But
so she knew what she was doing.
Totally.
She made this decision to give you these diaries. So why do you think she gave them to you?
I think that I had gained her confidence as someone who was trying to, who respected her and was doing a serious look at her life. And, you know, she was 92 years old. She was increasingly ill. She knew, maybe she figured, if not now, when.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, the diaries had been given to the George W. Bush Library, nobody else will be able to see them for another 34 years.
How long did it take you to go through them?
It took, I mean, I just, I would go to the George W. Bush Library and sit there from the minute they opened to the minute they closed, day after day after day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I knew her pretty well. I worked for her husband and for her essentially when he was vice president, then when he was president in the U.S. Trade Rep's office, and then for 43, the Pentagon, etc. And everything you said is absolutely right. And these people think she's the sweet, kind, right? No. Mary Madeline would tell you the same thing, is you never worried a day if 41 was mad at you. It's like, whatever, go away. Mm-hmm. If she was mad at you, you were terrified.
Oh, and she
absolutely terrified. And on the rare occasion, the ill-fated 92 Bush Quayle campaign was just a disaster in so many ways. On the rare occasion she would come over to the campaign office, it was like the scene from the opening scenes from Devil Wears Prada, where everyone hears she's coming and they run. You run. You're jumping out of windows. Because she was so tough, completely fair, but so tough.
A White House speech writer said that he would see her coming like down the driveway and he would hurriedly try to go in a different direction.
Absolutely.
Just for fear of what she might say.
Yeah.
And
it's like guarding
tests. One point,
I love this.
43 said to his mother, this is so-and-so. He's writing this key speech coming up. And she said to him, oh, good, now we'll know who to blame.
Yeah.
And yeah. I said, you know, surely she was kidding. And he said, I'm not sure.
No. She would always say exactly what she thought. And darned if she wasn't right. Mm-hmm. Oh, her political instincts were dead on.
But, you know, also willing to admit when she was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. she, you know, very late in life, and when she must have been about 91, Tim Neftali, who is a famous presidential historian, John Meacham brought him to have lunch with 41 and Barbara Bush in Kennebunkport.
Mm-hmm.
And Barbara Bush didn't know Tim Neftali, but they had a very lively lunch in which they ended up discussing that the Obama White House had just sent out a press release saying they had hired someone for the White House staff, and this person was transgender. Mm-hmm. And she was complaining how inappropriate that was. And Tim Neftali said to her, I'm a gay man, and I can tell you how meaningful that can be for someone who has felt excluded to know you can have a job like that. And in her diaries, she wrote, I had lunch today with Tim Neftali. I don't know who he is. He told me. So she never really caught on to the famous historian thing. She said, we had a discussion about this transgender issue, and I've decided that I was wrong and he was right. And she then sent him a note saying, mm-hmm. thank you for lunch. I just wanted to let you know that I decided that you were right and I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a woman who must have been about 90 years old then.
Yeah. And willing to write that down and put it in paper.
And and willing to change her view on an issue as sensitive as one as attitudes toward people who are transgender. Mm-hmm.
So take us back, again, if you know the family, you know the history, you know they lost a daughter, she's very young, Robin, and that it had a huge impact on them. Of course, I didn't know to have read this book, and you read what she wrote in her diaries. The impact of the loss of that daughter throughout her entire life, including her opinion on some issues like abortion, like AIDS.
It's amazing. I was going through the diaries, and in her diary from 1980, there she had stuck in there. Now, no one had gone through these diaries. No archivist, nobody. They were in big boxes the way they had arrived from her home. And so I'm opening up her 1980 diary, and there's this letter she had written to herself, folded up and tucked in the diary. And it was headlined, the top of it said, Thoughts About Abortion, because 1980 was the year that George H.W. Bush first ran for the White House. Mm-hmm. She knew she was going to get asked about abortion. And in this letter to herself, she says, she talks about the issue. She talks not about the politics of the issue, but the morality of the issue. And she says, toward the conclusion, she says, I remember the moment that Robin, my daughter, was born, and I felt her soul enter her body. And I remember the moment that Robin died, and I felt her soul leave her body. And if your soul enters your body at the moment of birth, abortion isn't murder. It shouldn't be up to the government. It should be up to the mother and the father and the doctor. Mm-hmm. And that was a position she, in fact, held for the rest of her life.
And AIDS too.
On AIDS, you know, she, you know, George Bush and George H. both the all the Bushes will cry at the drop of a hat. You know that. You can probably make them cry, right? I mean, they're
many times, sadly, right. For the wrong reasons.
They're easy criers.
Yeah,
Barbara Bush not such an easy crier. But when I was interviewing her, one of the interviews, she talked about when Robin was dying, and they had taken her to Sloan Kettering in New York for this brutal treatment, which didn't work. They brought her home to Midland, Texas for one last time so she could see her two big brothers, their friends, some of their relatives. And she said, with tears in her eyes, all these decades later, that some of her best friends refused to visit because they thought they would catch leukemia, which was the disease that Robin had. Mm-hmm. And years later, when she saw the stigma that surrounded people who had HIV/AIDS, she thought of that experience, and she took concrete steps at a time when this was not a given to address the stigma that mm-hmm. people with AIDS faced.
You say, you write a lot about how loved but underestimated, and it was on things like that and issues like that, changes in that administration and their policies were made because of what she did and what she said.
Yeah, and you know, you think about, so Robin dies. It affects Barbara Bush deeply. She makes AIDS a private, low-key cause of herself. She, her son, George W. Bush, told me in an interview I did for the book that his mother's interest in AIDS fueled his own interest in AIDS, mm-hmm. contributed to his decision to launch the PEPFAR initiative, which is one of the proudest parts of his legacy, giving treatment available to people in Africa who had HIV/AIDS. Her granddaughter, Barbara Bush, her namesake and granddaughter, told me that her grandmother's interest in AIDS helped her, was one reason she helped co-found the Global Health mm-hmm. Corps, mm-hmm. which addresses healthcare needs around the world, including on issues of AIDS. So you think about the death of this three-year-old girl and the millions of people whose lives have been saved as a consequence.
Mm-hmm. What surprised you the most? Because you knew the family well. You'd covered them extensively. You did know them more than the average bear. So what surprised you the most? And it had to have come from the diaries, I'm guessing. More from than the interviews with her?
You know, the interviews were great. The diaries were also extraordinary. And you know, when I did the first draft of the book, the first chapter in the first draft was about the 1988 campaign. Mm-hmm. The campaign that put her husband in the White House. And when I read it, I thought, this is all wrong. If it was a biography of George Bush, the first chapter should be 1988. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I said, what was the defining event for Barbara Bush? It was Robin. Mm-hmm. And so instead, I made the first chapter about Robin and then moved on. And 1988 fell in its chronological place, which was, I thought, where it belonged.
Mm-hmm. Again, we all know certain things about her, but certainly not to the degree we now know after reading The Matriarch. She considered suicide, suffered from depression. These are not things people knew.
And it's at odds with the impression we have of her as being such
it's
a
so
strong
tough.
Figure.
Yeah.
She and her husband came back from China in 1976. He no longer shared his job with her, given that it was all secret. Her kids had left home. She was going through menopause. She fell into a deep depression. The only person she told about it was her husband. She told me that she would be driving down the road and have an urge to steer the car in the path of an oncoming car. Or she'd be driving and think, I could steer this car into that tree to kill herself. And that she would have to pull off to the side of the road and wait for this impulse to pass before she could drive home. And this was such a, she kept this so secret that her brother, with whom she's very close, mm-hmm. and who's a wonderful guy. So I interviewed him and I asked him about this period when she was suicidal. And he basically said I was wrong. That
couldn't be
that serious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't have felt that way. Even though I knew that about it, both from what she wrote and also from what she told me in the interviews.
I think most people would look at the family from the outside and go, they got it made. Born with a silver spoon, blah, blah, blah. Kind of thing. She had this great life. Do you think she was a happy person?
Oh, she was so happy. I mean, not every single minute of every mm-hmm. single day, but she adored her children. She adored her grandchildren. She loved her husband. She had been kind of this middling student who thought she was fat and unattractive.
Because her mother told her so.
Because her mother told her that.
Yeah.
And she ended up living this extraordinary life. She was very worried when they left the White House that they would run out of money. not realizing, of course, when she wrote a memoir, great. She could sell it for millions of dollars, and then it would become a big bestseller because people actually wanted to read about her.
Okay, talk about two women in her life, Raisa Gorbachev and Nancy Reagan.
Meow.
Did not get along.
So Raisa Gorbachev, she didn't like Raisa Gorbachev. I said, were you friends? And she said, quote, friends is a big word, which I'm pretty sure meant no. But she cultivated Raisa Gorbachev because she thought that was helpful in the negotiations to end the Cold War. Nancy Reagan, I tell you, some people have asked, why did Barbara Bush agree to be interviewed? And in this first interview I did with her, where I was trying to cover a lot of ground, she told me the world's best story with such vigor that I'm pretty sure that's why she agreed to be interviewed, because she had been waiting for decades to tell this story. And this story, she and Nancy Reagan had unending run-ins. I mean, I knew as a reporter they weren't best friends. I did not realize until I did the book that they were mortal enemies.
Again, this is stunning. And Mary Madeline and I trading emails because they were never the same kind of person. Mm-hmm. They're from two very different worlds. Things mm-hmm. were different. Things were important to them. Never occurred to any of us it was this deep. Go ahead.
So Nancy Reagan did one more stupid offense. I mean, I'm telling you this from Barbara Bush's point
of view. Yes, exactly. Her words.
Nancy Reagan may have her own perspective on this, but I wrote a biography of Barbara Bush, so let me tell it from her perspective. So Nancy Reagan was constantly dissing the Bushes. In private, she would refer to them as the shrubs, which was not a compliment.
Sounding Kennedy-Johnson-esque.
Yes.
She did this kind of public diss of the Bushes on the day of Bill Clinton's inauguration, while the Bushes were basically in mourning for having lost, flying back to Houston. Nancy Reagan then calls Barbara Bush in Houston to try to make amends for this insulting interview she gave on ABC, which also resulted in a story in the New York Times. And Barbara Bush had a series of these calls over the years where Nancy Reagan would explain some offensive thing she'd done. And so Nancy Reagan says, you know, I just want to explain. And Barbara Bush said, I've heard enough explanations. I don't want any more explanations from you. And then she said something that we may have all said, which was, oh, my other line is ringing. This was not true. There was no other line ringing. She said, and don't you ever call me again. And she hung up.
So great.
And the two women never had an extended conversation again.
They met at some library event or something
Nixon's,
like that.
Right? Yeah. Richard Nixon's funeral.
That's right.
And in her where they said, exchanged pleasantries. And Barbara Bush said in her diary that she gave her a kiss, but she sounded like she regretted it.
I think you may be right. I think that Barbara Bush is just tough enough to think, she was thinking to herself, okay, there's only so much time left. I want that story out. This is a terrific opportunity.
I'm telling you, my jaw was on the ground. Press aide, this is a story that had not been told before.
Yeah.
Her long-term staffer who was sitting in on the interview, he was like, had a similar look on his face.
Hadn't heard that one before.
And it's not like I very cleverly caught it out of her. Yeah. I said something like, how was your relationship with Nancy Reagan? And this followed.
How does she impact future first spouses, male or female?
Well, I think her view was take advantage of the platform, but do what you want to do.
Yeah.
And that different first ladies will handle that different ways. She really didn't like, this will startle you, Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But she sent Melania Trump a very nice letter right after the election in 2016 that said, you'll love the White House because it is a wonderful place to live and the White House staff is wonderful. And she said, let me give you one piece of unasked for advice, which is a phrase I like very much and now use all the time, unasked for advice. She said, my unasked for advice is if Barron is going to go live in the White House, think about letting a friend come and live with him because it can be a lonely place for a child.
Nice. Very nice. Okay, looking ahead, you've got another one in the works.
I'm working on
Nancy
another one.
Pelosi. Nancy D'Alessandro.
Did you check in with her before you signed this contract?
I did not. On the theory.
Girl. Learning, aren't you?
So she is as much Nancy D'Alessandro as she is Nancy Pelosi. Her father, as you know,
absolutely.
Mayor of Baltimore. Her mother, an extraordinary figure in her own right. A real groundbreaking figure at a time when it was hard for women to do that. She's been, I've been working on this for about a year. I've got to say, Nancy Pelosi has served me well by staying in the news in the past year, for which I'm very grateful.
You're picking good ones. This is good. When does the Nancy Pelosi book come out?
We're never supposed to ask authors that.
When it's done.
But I don't think, I'll tell you what, I don't think the story's done yet.
Yeah.
I think we have to wait and see what happens before we know the end of the story.
Okay, but then at some point you have to say it's done.
Yes. True.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
after the election.
Only time will tell.
I think she's fascinating for lots of different reasons. I think she's fascinating in that maybe this is the moment that has caused her to rise above her talents. From what I hear of the father, I think, okay, that was a really, really talented person. And you watch Nancy Pelosi from afar, you think, political, very, very, predictable, those kinds of things. I think these times have caused her to rise above what her talents might have been.
I would disagree a little.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you one of the big insights about Nancy Pelosi, I think, is that she is terrible at the things you see, and mm-hmm. she is fantastic at the things you don't see.
Yeah.
So she is not a very good communicator.
She's a terrible speaker. Mm-hmm.
She's not a good big speaker. She's not great on the Sunday show. She's a hell of a speaker of the house. She is exactly right. And when it comes to holding together a caucus, mm-hmm. passing legislation, there she has some really serious skills.
Yep. Well, it will be.
That, by the way.
Well, thank you very much. And I would have anyway.
It will be wonderful. And I really mean this. I don't recommend many memoirs. I liked Michelle Obama's a lot. I thought it was very honest.
She sold more books than I did.
Shocking that. But the matriarch, Barbara Bush, and the making of an American dynasty, a phrase she rejected, by the way, right?
She did. She hated matriarch. She hated dynasty.
What was the title? Did she want it?
I said, okay, what would your title be? And she said, The Fat Lady Sings Again.
It's really worth getting.
Jesus.
But her mother kept telling her she was. That could stay with her. Susan Page, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you all.
Stay with us. We're going to, now we are going to go to a segment we call Deserted Island, where we make strange recommendations about different things. And it being a new decade, my pick was New Year's reading resolutions. And I'll go first. I'm going to read more fiction. I tend not to read much fiction. I've been reading a lot thanks to this show. But I've started with, Michael, can you slide that to me? It's called Nothing to See Here by a guy named Kevin Wilson. And it is, all I can say is it's about some twins who spontaneously combust. And that sounds like a really bad whatever, but it's really fun. It's really interesting. It is a terrific read.
It really happened.
It's could have, I guess. It's by Kevin Wilson, and it turns out Kevin Wilson is friends with our friend Mike Crowley, who has been on the show, who is terrific. Mm-hmm. So I'm starting with fiction as my very in broad category. New Year's.
It's interesting. My resolution is I want to read more nonfiction.
There you go.
Particularly,
I've got 300 books you can read.
Historical nonfiction. I'm totally uneducated, but very well trained, and very well trained at reading literary fiction.
Yeah, you know how to read.
I'd like to read more memoirs, and actually, part of my resolution is going to be, so today is Henry's 6-month birthday.
Happy birthday, Henry.
So Walker is 2.5, Henry's 6 months, and we had so much time with Walker to go to all the available baby lap time, toddler story times, and I loved exposing him to different voices. So I want to make sure that I'm not just reading the boys' books that we grew up reading, but that we're going out of our way to do research on different voices, different styles, different sounds, different looks, and make sure that we're not just exposing him, to the same Northwest DC voice. That is very natural for us, and there's value in hearing that, but I want to make sure we can push him a little bit into a different circle.
That's a good one. David?
Well, as always, being less learned, I always want to read more classics. I read lots of biographies and histories and things because I love history.
Don't do Moby Dick. Just save your one
I just
right
want,
there.
No, I want to read, I read the Iliad a long time ago. I'd like to read it again and see if I can figure out more of it this time because I really liked it. It was just that I knew that a lot of it was above me. So I'd like to read more things like that, more real classical literature. But like my resolve to lose 15 pounds is probably not
I read somewhere that Warren Buffett says, if you do nothing else, read 500 words a day. Just because it gets your brain working in certain ways. The thing, there have now been a couple studies about fiction saying it helps people be more empathetic, which I think I could work on.
Sure.
I need to work on that.
Try reading some ancient plays because they move fast.
Yeah. I want to do that.
People get killed.
Yeah, it's okay.
What's that story?
It's fine. Susan, do you have any? Do you have no time to read?
My resolution is to finish the book on Nancy Pelosi.
Atta girl.
And at that time, I'll be happy to read anything else.
Anything but. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for episode number 49. And come back next week. We are going to have a terrific show, and we're going to have Dr. Claiborne Carson, who is currently the head of the MLK Institute at Stanford. He is the man who brought the autobiography of Martin Luther King to life. Absolutely fascinating guy. And we'll talk to you next week. And go LSU or Clemson.
Whichever one you like.